TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Scientific Freedom in the Age of Biotechnology. There was an atmosphere of siege among the students, grad students, and the few tenured professors at UC Berkeley who had the courage to come as they readied Dwinnell Hall for an extraordinary event. Four scientists were about to speak out on the rising power of biotechnology corporations over academic research and freedom. Two of the speakers, Arpad Pushtai and Ignacio Chapella, had already been punished for their stance. Pushtai had been fired from the Roward Institute in Scotland after showing that genetically engineered potatoes made laboratory rats seriously ill. Chapella had proven contamination by GMO corn off Mexico's Cradle of Corn in Oaxaca and had just been denied tenure at UC Berkeley. Dwinnell Hall was filled over capacity, and we all had the sense that we were attending an event that could change the public perception of genetic engineering, challenge the power of corporations, encourage scientists to speak out, and give us a safer world. The event, The Pulse of Scientific Freedom in the Age of Biotechnology, took place in December 2003. Through the years that passed, all four scientists who spoke that night have had the courage to stand by their scientific work and to warn the public of the dangers of genetically modified plants and animals. In acknowledgement of their courage and integrity, I'm bringing you their voices again at a time when, finally, the public is demanding the labeling of GMOs. Here's my 2003 introduction. This program is about academic freedom, independent thinking, corporate intervention into science, the buying of academia, the collusion of regulatory agencies with the very corporations they are to oversee, and, maybe most frightening of all, the invasion of the inner spaces of the self-organization of life. The science of biology, once respected as the science of life, is being transformed by corporations who sponsor and command a new field of scientific research and industrial production called biotechnology. We are asked to get used to biotechnology in the name of progress. Corn and soy have a toxin inserted into every cell of the plant. Plants are bred that can't be killed by currently used chemicals. After only 8 years of releases of these plants into nature, frightening things are happening. The toxins inside the plants are killing not only the plant pests. Monarch butterfly caterpillars die from engineered corn pollen. Herbicide resistance gets passed on to weeds. Meanwhile, engineered plants are showing up on roadsides, in private gardens, organic farms, and even in the cradle of corn, the remote mountains of Oaxaca, Mexico, and crossbreed with pure ancient strains. But we, the public, learn little about these very serious events, because scientists who are ringing the alarm are fired, slandered, or ignored. And the media, especially in the US, are silent. You are about to witness the first meeting of four such scientists: Arpad Pushtai, Ignacio Chapella, Tyrone Hayes, and John Losey. Arpad Pushtai was an advocate of genetic engineering until his research with rats showed serious damage to their immune system and organ growth when they were fed with genetically engineered potatoes. He was fired from his job as principal scientific officer at the Roward Institute in Scotland, a job he had held for 30 years. His research files were seized and his home broken into. Tyrone Hayes did research on the effects of atrazine, the world's most widely used agricultural chemical, as part of a study on breast and prostate cancer. he found damage to tissue and organs of amphibians, including sex changes caused by fluctuating levels of estrogen and testosterone. He was concerned that these changes occurred at levels 30 times lower than allowed for our drinking water. His research was suppressed. Michael Pollan, author of The Botany of Desire, and Ignacio Chapella deserve thanks for organizing the event. The investigative reporter Mark Dowie was the moderator. Each participant was asked to give a brief personal history. Here first is Arpad Pusztai.
I am Arpad Pusztai. I used to be a very conventional scientist. I did my work, wrote a paper, published it, and nothing actually prepared me for what followed after my very simple announcement in 1998. This was a little television broadcast, 150 seconds of it, 12 sentences, in which because our money for the research which we did came from the British taxpayers, including myself, I thought that it was quite right for me to report back to them that what is the potential problem with GM food. We did a research which cost $3 million equivalent to the British taxpayer, and we found that there were some worrying developments. We had this genetically modified potato, which we fed as a substitute to rats, and we did get some worrying effects. In the long term, the genetically modified potatoes, even when they were fully cooked, did not support the growth of the rats. These were young rats. Now you know that you can't do any experiments with children. So they were standing in for children. And we found that there were some problems, and we couldn't explain that. Then the next thing was that because young rats developed their own immune system, their endocrine system, their bacteria flora, they are in a sort of transition before they become adults. And we found that when we are feeding these rats with genetically modified potatoes, their immune system slowed down. It was not developing so well. Their organs, their guts, their pancreas, their liver were not developing as well as the ones which had been fed on the parent line, non-genetically modified potatoes. So we were really perplexed. Quite truly, I tell you that I was very perplexed because we have taken the gene and the gene product after 6.5 years of studies for not seeing the things which we were seeing. And we couldn't understand it. And then we did some critical experiment which had drawn the attention, our attention, and probably even more importantly, the biotech industry's attention to the fact that insertion into the genome did cause some unpredictable changes with potentially harmful consequences. Now the whole thing, I just, as I say, simple scientist, I reported these facts to my peers, which were the British taxpayers, and told them there are problems, and I don't see corresponding effort to clear up these problems, and that worried me even more. So I naively reported this to the British public, and the consequences of that was really quite unbelievable. I never thought that as a conventional scientist, I would have reporters parking and living on my drive-in to try to get my views on anything. I'm a very polite and humble person, and I couldn't really understand that how this happened. Till somebody explained to me that what I put my foot in was a multi-billion dollar business. So I leave this to you to ponder on that. How does a straightforward, simple scientist get into this field of major international controversy? And perhaps you are better equipped to deal with it than I was. Perhaps the rest of the panel is better equipped to deal with it, but I leave it to you. Thank you.
This was Arpad Pushtai, recorded at a meeting at UC Berkeley. The event was broadcast live on the internet. Here is Tyrone Hayes, assistant professor at UC Berkeley.
My name is Tyrone, and I have to say the one thing that we certainly have in common is that I was very naive in the sense that I was asked by a company to evaluate a chemical, and I, at the time, certainly didn't think about the implications or about the compound, or it was just simple science that I was getting into. I study amphibian developmental endocrinology, which means I'm interested in the role of hormones in frog development. In particular, the role of sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen, the same hormones that are important in human sexual development, as well as thyroid hormone, another hormone important in growth and neural development. And I was, in part, encouraged by the university to develop one of our models as a test, one of our amphibian models, as sort of a test for example, compounds that might induce breast cancer. So we were studying estrogens that might induce breast cancer. And as part of filing a patent, you are encouraged to show efficacy, that if the university invests in your intellectual property, that you know, there's the possibility that it will bring in money. And it did, in fact. I ended up consulting for Novartis, which then became Syngenta, and they asked me to evaluate a compound, atrazine, an herbicide, that, again, I was very naive. It turns out it's the number one herbicide used in the world on the U.S.'s number one crop. It's primarily used on corn. We tested the compound, and we found that this compound, atrazine, caused male frogs to develop female characteristics. Male frogs would develop ovaries and, in some case, would develop eggs in their testes, and would also chemically castrate or demasculinize exposed males. Their testosterone would go away, and they would start to make estrogen. I reported this to the company, to Syngenta, to EcoRisk, which was the consulting company working for Syngenta at the time. And what they encouraged me to do was to repeat the work and to continue to repeat the work at a slower pace. And I should point out that I wasn't, and still am not, opposed to repeating the work. It was a very surprising result. Very low doses, actually a tenth of what was reported here, 0.1 parts per billion. And it was a dose that, you know, is 30 times lower than what's allowed in drinking water for humans. It also turned out that the company was aware of publications that had shown the same mechanism, the conversion of testosterone to estrogen, had been reported in mammals, including human cell lines, and that there were data suggesting that atrazine, through the same mechanism potentially, might be involved in increased breast cancer and induced mammary cancers, or as they put it, earlier onset of mammary cancers in rats, and was associated with an increase in prostate cancers in their own factories, again, through what we're calling endocrine disruption, potentially. I eventually resigned from working with Syngenta and EcoRisk, in part because of the ways that they had tried to slow the work, in my opinion, suppressed the work. And I did repeat the work on my own without their funding. I was then approached by November of 2000, I was approached by Syngenta again with an offer that I should make a proposal to Syngenta to get involved with them in the research again. And my response was, how can I make a proposal for work that I've already done on my own money? Essentially, they tried to purchase the work that I had already done. And I did not think about that at all. I assure you, I refused to do it. Their next, their next approach was to request a meeting here at Berkeley, alone with me. And I invited instead my students, from graduate students, undergraduates, my dean, my chair, as many people as I could. But they proceeded with their efforts to discredit my work. And they brought in a statistician who claimed that there were errors and that my students had made errors, etc. And I asked them to leave at that point. So I repeated the work, and when I published it, and I just did it. I did what my older peers that I looked up to told me to do. It's just do the science, stick to the science, and stay out of the politics. So I did just that. I didn't say a word. And when I completed the work, I published it in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And then I was contacted by the Environmental Protection Agency. And again, after I published a second paper showing that this effect occurred in the wild, a paper that I published in Nature, I was again contacted by the Environmental Protection Agency, which was sort of my second piece of surprise. They repeatedly, including over email, warned me not to provoke the company, that the company was big and that they would attempt to destroy my career. These are things that the EPA warned me about. But we continued to publish the work, and the company then continued to hire multiple scientists who would present themselves as independent scientists from University of Florida, from Michigan State, from a number of universities, who would do things like, for example, repeat the work but not care for the animals, so 90% of the animals would die, and so they would claim that they didn't repeat our work, things like that. And I think one of the biggest losses in that is that they were often hiring students to repeat that work. So some of the people that they hired to quote-unquote repeat my work were students getting their PhD. Some of the students, such as one at University of Florida, managed to get out of the situation and start her career over. Others finished having just repeated my work and repeated it very poorly. One of the other discouraging things is I discovered in the middle of this all, I was asked to review a proposal by a major company that does, you know, some bioscreening and testing, a company called Battelle Laboratories, I guess. Can I name names? Somehow, somebody didn't pay attention, and I was asked to review the proposal, which turned out to be verbatim, word for word, my work plagiarized out of copyrighted published books. And so I approached the EPA about this. This was a company that the Environmental Protection Agency was making a contract with who will do this kind of amphibian work. And I approached them with it, and their offer to me was, what if we contract some of the work to you? My response was, wait, you've stolen my car, and now you're asking if it's okay if you let me borrow it on the weekend. when I brought this up to the Environmental Protection Agency and said, if I catch my students in my classroom plagiarizing, they would get kicked out of school. The reply from the Environmental Protection Agency was, the rules that operate in the ivory tower do not function in the real world. And the other thing that was disappointing to me was that the company completely denied having seen my data when it became public. And when I reported to the EPA and said, look, I have the Federal Express receipts of when I sent the data to them, instead of being prosecuted for not turning in data regarding adverse effects, there's a law against that, the EPA allowed them to revise their story. And the company revised their story saying, well, we saw the report, but we never saw the raw data. And then when I faxed a copy of my raw data with their handwriting on it, the EPA then sent me another email and said, well, this is an offense, and they're going to be prosecuted for it. And then a couple days later, I received an email that the company had surprisingly arranged a meeting across the street from the EPA, and that was the last I heard of the case. Anyway, I'll stop there with my series of disappointments. And
that was Tyrone Hayes, assistant professor at UC Berkeley, recorded at an event on scientific freedom in the age of biotechnology. The panelists were given time to question each other. Tyrone Hayes asks a question, Arpad Pushtai and Ignacio Chapela answer.
I'd like to ask the panel, in your own cases, what do you think the responsibility of your institutions were? In other words, what could have been done different? What could have been done differently?
In my case, my institution, my director, who was sort of going for a big job, when he had the political pressure on him, he just simply decided that his future is much bigger than my future is. So he sacrificed me on the altar of his future. This actually happened, although he had almost exactly the same opinion as I had. But he was a political beast, and I wasn't. I thought that science and what I grew up in and what I believed in was far more important than future for an individual future. He obviously disagreed with me.
There is a long history that it's difficult to go against in the structures. The structures really react in very predictable ways. But I think, referring to the two previous questions, my personal experience in this adventure was that we actually were able to go to Sacramento, and we have people from the legislature in this audience. We're supposed to have a system of accountability. You know, this is not the University of Novartis. This is the University of California, and you know, it's as though, it's as if I came to your office and I bought a computer for you, and then I said, well, the office is mine, plus all your writing. We seem to forget that we are actually accountable to somebody. Those people are also sleeping at the wheel. You know, I'm sorry, those people from the legislature here, but the system is there, and the question is, do we use it? Do we force the situation so that the system has to be used and that we hold their feet to the fire there? Just as I feel we are holding the feet to the fire of our colleagues in the scientific environment right now.
That was Ignacio Chapela, one of the panelists whose research on the contamination of Mexican corn by GMO corn was suppressed. The moderator, Mark Dowie, asks the next question.
Here is my question for anyone in the panel. As a society now, we're trying very hard to minimize the influence of money over politics. Should we not be thinking about ways to remove the influence of money over science?
I had a huge respect for my colleagues. And when I look at them, they have gone in a direction which probably, as an old scientist, a sort of clapped out old scientist who's been put out on green pastures. I don't really understand. Please, all these clever people, come up with some sort of answer very soon, because science will be lost. Biological science will be lost. We're going to end up with a lot of papers and products which are not worth the paper they are written on. So please, all the economists and whatever, come and rescue us, because we got into a real jam, and we must be rescued from it for all our sake.
Chris Henke says, though I'm sympathetic to the theme of the panel and the experiences of the panelists, I'd like to play devil's advocate. One early theme in the discussion is the suppression of controversial science. But is it appropriate to call most of these cases instances of suppression? Surely each panelist has faced intense pressure and criticism, but at the same time, their research has been published in some of the most prestigious science publications, much to the consternation of their critics. Isn't there something promising about the amount of publicity and public debate that have surrounded each panelist's research?
My data was never published or reported to the EPA the way it was supposed to. My data was published after I left and after I did the work out of pocket.
So. Thank you.
I see.
And I should point out that that also involves a lot of undergraduates working for no salary to repeat that work. So, you know, I also want to point out that some of the suppression comes not at the publication stage, but even before that. And I think primarily about the students who, for example, at the University of Florida at Michigan, who got involved in this, and their jobs were to repeat my work and to show that I was wrong, not to answer a question, not to find the answer, but to find a particular answer. And if they didn't start to find that answer, then, you know, they got shifted on to other projects or protocols got changed or experiments got terminated.
Do you know how much we suffered for that wretched paper in The Lancet? Have you any idea? Yes, we managed to publish very important pieces of research. But what you have to ask that how many other pieces of research which have been done, which should have been done, had not been published. That will tell you how healthy our state of affairs is in this business.
That was Arpad Pushtai, one of four scientists whose research had been suppressed because it ran counter to the economic interests of the biotechnology industry. This was part one of a two-part program on scientific freedom in the age of biotechnology. Next time you will hear from Ignacio Chapella and John Losey and their research on genetically engineered corn. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order an audio CD by calling 1-707-463-2654. And I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation or CD order keeps this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654 for information on how to order. You can get your CD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.